Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 24th day of Anno Domini 2026. And you, you lucky people, you're listening to Sound Bites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour for your edification and delectation, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things you choose, nothing loose, kick off your shoes. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news. But first bit of news, I'm beginning to think that it's just possible that summer is almost over.
You think?
It's just a feeling I have.
We could be on the
edge anyway. On the cusp. I understand that. All right. It's a new year, and that means a whole batch of new bugs for Windows 11. Yes, already. And it appears that the major culprit isn't hackers or malicious actors or even alien invaders. Nope. This time, the major culprit is Microsoft's own January Patch Tuesday update. Released on January 13th, the first major Windows update of the year has had just one important mission: to resolve the 114 security vulnerabilities putting Windows users at risk since the December 2025 Patch Tuesday. Several were rated critical, and at least one was already being exploited. Oh, and as a side quest, the January update was supposed to fix a few outstanding issues, some of which were, of course, caused by the December update. Apparently, the January update actually triggered a few bugs of its own. A couple have been resolved, but more haven't been fixed than have been. In one bug, people bumped into sign-in problems trying to remotely connect to a cloud PC via Microsoft's remote desktop. To resolve this bug, Microsoft rolled out an out-of-band patch on January 17th. That patch will appear in Windows Update, but only if your version of Windows qualifies and is affected by the specific issue. In another bug, some systems with secure launch enabled would restart instead of shutting down or going into hibernation mode. Secure launch protects your PC from bootkit malware that tries to infect your system before Windows loads. Again, the fix will appear in Windows Update only if your Windows version qualifies and your computer is affected. So if you're on Windows 10, you get none of that, by the way. That's
none of the problems.
Well, you get some of the
problems, but none of the problems
they weren't in 10.
Right. The third bug clobbers the classic flavor of Microsoft Outlook. Trying to open Outlook triggers a not responding message. You can't even attempt to open or reopen Outlook without ending the process in Task Manager or restarting the PC. And if you can get into the program, emails don't appear in the Sent Items folder even though they've been sent. Plus, Outlook keeps re-downloading the same emails. This bug seems to affect Outlook users with PST files stored on OneDrive, which is, by the way, automatic. So unless you've changed it, it's all of you. So far, Microsoft has no fix for this one, but does suggest a few temporary workarounds. You can use the web version of Outlook instead of the desktop client, and you can move your PST files out of OneDrive and save them in a different spot. That's tricky, and they don't tell you how to do it, but you can. Also triggered by the Also triggered by the January 13th update, some apps may freeze or trigger an error when you try to open files from or save them to cloud-based storage, such as Dropbox or, wait for it, OneDrive. When opening some apps, you'll trigger an error. Microsoft is silent on how to deal with any of these except for telling you to uninstall the January update. Seriously. So you can either have all the December bugs or the January bugs, but not no bugs. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Windows bugs abound. And your choices are: I'm really frustrated, I'm dealing with it okay, I haven't been too affected yet, and wait, you still use Windows? So far, we have 31 votes, and wait, you still use Windows is significantly in the lead.
That's only a permanent fix.
And followed by, I haven't been too affected yet. You notice I did not put it, I haven't been affected, because trust me, you have. You may not have noticed it. You may not have been inconvenienced by it. but you have been infected. There is no version of Windows that doesn't have a bug.
It's a matter of time.
It's just a matter of time till you hit it. So, and of course, you can vote in the poll. It's very easy. Just head on over to soundbites.org. That's Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, and vote in the poll. And then if you have anything you'd like to say about that or anything else, keep it clean, you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll free at 800-790-0415. I say keep it clean because I have talked to some people about Windows bugs, and they've been passionate.
Choice words.
They've been passionate. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, it makes you not want to update. And then you get hit by the thing the bug was fixing.
That's exactly right. So you have a choice. You get, and that's the whole idea behind this. Oh, just uninstall the update. Well, then I have all last month's bugs that are still bothering me.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you get a choice of these bugs or those bugs, but not no bugs.
Yep. Makes you pine for the early days when you had a typewriter. No.
And then you just had to change the ribbon regularly.
Yeah.
Or pine for Linux, where I haven't had a problem. Small, little, tiny problems that are easily fixable in decades. Decades.
With the snowmageddon that's being forecast.
Yeah.
Make sure all your extra batteries are charged up.
If you have a power bank, make sure it's charged up. One of the things you can do if you do have a power outage and you have an uninterruptible power supply, turn off your computer, and then that power supply can recharge your phone.
Yep. Which uses less power than your computer.
Which was a lot. You can recharge your phone for weeks on a UPS.
Yeah.
So, be aware that we have that possibility. We'll see. I found my power bank, made sure it's 100% charged. Elaine cannot find her power bank, so I'll be looking for it this afternoon.
Yeah, well, I've got my ham radios, I've got a Go Box that has a 32 amp hour supply in it that I keep fully charged. So, yeah, that'll charge some cell phones, and plus I could, if that goes down too, I can always just jump on the radio.
All right. Or you could just, read a book. Take a nap. There's an idea.
I like that one better.
That's a good idea.
Really relax the brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the original whole point of ham radio is a disaster relief, being able to coordinate on the radio, which doesn't use all that much power. Are you limited to one watt? Are you?
No.
Well, it doesn't use much power unless you've got the kind of rigs he has. 15 radios.
Yeah.
62
no, I'm
antennas.
I'm still 100 watts.
100 watts. Yeah.
What they call 100 watts in a wire. Matter of fact, since you mentioned that today, this starting an hour ago was Winter Field Day. Where folks literally are out in parks or different areas running off a battery and setting up to do just that, emergency disasters, because ham radio has played a big part in some of these other countries where, storms and everything else have wiped out all cell phone communications and everything else. But due to ham radio, they've been able to make contact with people. Because it is so simple to just throw a wire up into the tree and tune your radio and make contact.
Are CB radios still a thing?
They're gaining big popularity right now in the ham world because, again, still with the CB radio, just like the old days, you didn't need to actually pass a test to get a license. You still need a license for your call sign. But you don't have to, because you're on a lower frequency, narrower part of the band, and limited.
CB is limited to 4 watts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty short range.
Yeah.
Well,
it's short range, but back in the day when every truck on the road and every car on the road had a CB radio, you didn't need to go too far to make contact with somebody.
All right. I've got a stick that I put on top. They call it a ham stick on top of the car.
We used to call them antennas.
This is totally different, but I've got a radio that only puts out 20 watts. And with just that simple antenna sitting on top of the car and that little radio, I've made contact just this week, contacts to Spain, England, and France. All through just that, you know, 20 watts.
I was living in Detroit. And I was talking to a guy, and he said, I'm looking to get to such and so. And I started to give him directions. And about the fifth or sixth direction, he said, there's no four-way here. What? There's no four-way here. I said, where are you? He said, I'm at the corner of such and such and such. I said, yeah, that's a four-way stop. He said, listen, I've been living in St. Louis my entire life. Wait a minute. Hold on. Hold on. Where are you? I'm in St. Louis. I'm in Detroit.
Yep.
The fact that I managed to get you that far is a miracle.
Cool.
Yep.
Actually, when I moved to St. Louis, I looked that guy up. I still had his call sign. And I got in touch with him. But yeah, it just bounced off the ionosphere somewhere, and suddenly, clear as day. CB radio with a guy in St. Louis from Detroit.
Oh, the skip is hysterical. Unbelievable. You do what they call long path or short path. It's how your signal goes around the world and literally bounces off the atmosphere and back down. And people can be stunned, especially like this past summer, 10 meters was wide open.
Yeah.
It's a band that you can talk on, folks. And people here in the States, we're talking to people in Australia, and even over one friend of mine was talking to a gentleman in Beijing, China. Just like we're talking here. It was that clear. But they're short periods. They may come up for maybe an hour or two or just a few minutes. And you got to be able to take advantage of it. And
until I moved to St. Louis, I never heard that guy again. Clearly some little weirdness in the atmosphere that let us connect.
Well, it's like the aurora borealis. You know how the northern lights will all of a sudden flare up?
Yep.
And sometimes we can see them all the way down here into Rochester.
If we didn't have cloud cover.
Yeah, well, which we usually do most of the time.
Which we always do.
Looking at our the history page on the jazz901.org website, radio station started with 10 watts.
This one?
Yep.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And 1973.
It's not.
And now we're 15,000 watts.
15,000 watts. Nice.
It's not always about the power. It's, you know, the antennas and the equipment that you're using to get out.
Right. And for the station, they are constrained by the FCC to a certain frequency at a certain distance, at a certain power level, and certain directions.
Yeah, direction is the big thing. Where you point your antenna is,
at night you have to change it so it doesn't leak into Canada.
Well, apparently we can be heard well out into Lake Ontario.
Oh, yeah.
So those of you out boating in this weather, get indoors now! But welcome.
Yeah, people should appreciate that we're even here today.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because I was close.
Well, there's so much panic over nothing yet. Tomorrow night is going to be horrible.
No, that's not what I was panicking over. What I didn't want to really do was haul my butt out of bed early to go out and, you know, it was only, I think it was like 6 degrees or something like that.
Minus four when I got up. Thank you very much.
I didn't see what it felt like.
No, that was the actual temperature when I woke up at 7 a.m. Minus 4 degrees. Oh. I almost just went back to bed.
Well, I got up, got dressed, and went outside to hop on the tractor to snowblow. Because otherwise I ain't getting out. And it was like, I hope they appreciate that we're going. Yep.
Well, when I went out to brush off my car, first time I brushed off my new car in the snow, by the time I was done, I could not feel my hands. And I was wearing gloves. I was wearing good gloves, good insulated gloves.
They're not really. The gloves that you see in the what they use out in the Arctic are really thick.
You know,
you're not going to be doing much typing or that type of stuff.
Yeah, right.
You're lucky if you can grab a hold of a stick or something just to keep you up.
I will say my car warmed up very nicely. Thank you very much. And then I have heated seats. So,
that's one thing. Monday, I wound up getting my car back.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, they fixed
it. I saw it. I did see it.
Yeah, they fixed it up. Nice, unbelievable job. And looks like brand new. And it's just so nice to be able to do a remote start. Because with that other car that they had loaned me, they didn't have it. Or they might have had it, and I didn't have an app, but, you know, it was only a rental. But to be able to now just get back on the schedule, I wake up in the morning, and it's, I don't have to worry about it because I've already set the preset to start the car up 10 minutes before I got to go to work. Boom, I go out in this nice, warm car.
Yes. Yeah, I still had to brush it off, though. But it was And it's a big car. I mean, I used to drive a Nissan Cube. I could reach all the way across the windshield.
Yeah.
Now I have to go around to the other side of the car. What the hell is that all about?
When you used to be able to roll down the other window.
Yes.
When you used to have to roll down windows.
Right. I owned a Volkswagen Beetle for a time, and I could scrape off the back window from the driver's seat. Now, it was a Volkswagen Beetle, so you had to do that. It didn't have much in the way of heat. But I could.
That's where the engine was, so wouldn't that heat the back window?
It's shockingly not. It's air-cooled engine, that's why.
And if the wires broke on it, you were really hosed.
Yeah, you were. Yeah, you were. All right, to the phones. Our first caller is Fred from Rochester, New York. What's up, Fred?
Hey, I just wanted to call and tell you I appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you so much. We love to hear that.
Glad. Thank you for all your help through all these years that I've been listening.
Thanks.
And especially recently, I had problems with the keyboard staying connected to my PC, and you had suggested a different brand. I switched to a Logi MX.
Hell yeah.
Mechanical. I have the Logi mouse that I had been using for a while, and it works perfectly. Thank you very much.
Excellent. That's what we like to hear.
So today's poll and some conversations about Linux versions last week. When I switched to Linux, I did search on which one was the newest one, which part of why I picked Ubuntu is because it looks nothing like Windows.
Yes.
You know, when I got rid of Windows, I got rid of Windows for various other reasons, but I didn't need anything reminding me that I got rid of Windows.
Yeah, and nice. It makes sense. You're using Ubuntu with GNOME, so it definitely looks different, and it definitely works just fine.
It works just fine. And everything is there. All the knobs and buttons and the heat controls and the radio tuner is all in the same. All there. It's just, you know, over to this side or that side or.
It works.
Yep, works every day.
Simple.
Good for you, Fred.
So I just wanted to call in and thank you for being there. I'm not going outside today. Thank you very much.
thank you, Fred. We appreciate your appreciation. Thanks so much. Have a terrific day and stay warm.
You too.
Yeah. See, we're here freezing our tuchuses off so that you can stay inside and give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Call now and make the sacrifice we went through worthwhile. But yeah. It was dang cold.
Of course, at our age now, that doesn't help. Warming up takes a hell of a lot longer time.
It does. My knees were locked by the time I was done brushing the car off.
The old arthritis.
Exactly. I have to say that driving this car in the snow was it's all wheel drive. So I started out a little too aggressive and started to skid a little and thought, oh, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's all-wheel drive, not spikes in the tires.
Yeah. One of the things I always hope is people remember it's all-wheel go, not all-wheel stop.
Exactly.
You still slide as much as the other guy.
Exactly. But yeah, so I was, you know, I felt less trepidation doing that. So it was very nice. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Guy from Rochester, New York. What's up, Guy?
How you guys doing today? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
So I just have a question for you for antivirus. I've used Avast for many years. And so now I'm kind of thinking, I don't know if I want to stick with them or not. And so I just wondered what your thoughts were of Avast, if anything else you thought might be something else that might be a little better. Part of my reason for switching is because the recently had Avast a few years ago, I guess, sold unknowing to most of their customers, and they weren't supposed to sell their email address, which then started a class action lawsuit. All that. That's my question, is I'm just trying to see what your thoughts were.
In terms of antivirus programs, Avast is still pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
AVG is excellent.
Super Agent.
And they're both owned by the same parent company now.
Well, that's
one,
exactly
one bought
right.
the other.
Right.
I always forget which way it was.
But there's Komodo, there's Panda Software, and all of those are pretty good. Are you on Windows? Assume so, because you said Avast, yeah. The Windows Defender is actually good. The problem is it isn't updated quite as often as some of the others.
That can get two or three updates a day.
Okay. Right. So it's good, and viruses are less of a problem than they used to be.
But other types of malware are more common now.
Yeah. Right. I like AVG, Super Anti-Spyware, and Malware Bytes. Those three combos work great. I've used them for years. Have not had any problems. Like they were, Nick and Steve were just saying, you know, you got to still have an antivirus program. That is a must. There's no ands, ifs, or buts about it. And you need to have spyware and malware, because they're now turning to go to that to grab information and sell that. So you got to cover your bases all the way around.
Okay.
So Avast is still a good program. Don't get us wrong.
No, it's still good.
If you wanted to keep that, it would be more than acceptable.
And you've got a list of them on the Security Tango website.
Right, mm-hmm. And I was about to say, if you go to securitytango.com,
bingo.
Under Windows Software is an antivirus section. It lists some of them. Obviously, it doesn't list all of them. There are hundreds. But it lists some of them and talks a little bit about them.
And all the major ones seem to work about the same. PCMag and the typical testing sites, they test them all every year. And it's like they're 98%, 97%, 96.5%, 99%. They're all about the same. They all miss one that another one got, but then they got one that another one missed.
Right, but if you run more than one at a time, then they interfere with each other and they conflict, and that's a problem. So you really just got to pick one and go. And like we said, Avast is still a good program.
Mm-hmm.
They sold to AVG, and AVG now has their list, but it's still a good program.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
I find Avast is still a good product. Like I said, Windows Defender, which is from Microsoft, is actually a very good program. It runs at a very low level, and it runs very well.
And that's one of the biggest problems with AV, is that they have to hook into the lowest levels of the OS,
right,
where Windows Defender from Microsoft already has that built in.
Right. The problem with Windows Defender is it doesn't seem to update as often as some of the others. But beyond that, it is still a good program, and it's certainly better than no program. So... generally speaking, if that comes with the machine, if you've turned that on, don't feel bad. It's not a bad program at all. Either way, you're in good shape. But Dave is right. You need an antivirus, an anti-malware, and an anti-spyware program. All right, we're going to take a quick break while you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free at 800-790-0415. We're going to take a quick break to thaw out, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with a whole lot more of the longest running computer show in the noon. No, make a sentence out of that, and we will see you in just a couple of minutes. And my tongue is frozen.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Jack from Gates, New York on the line. What's up, Jack?
Some weeks ago, you were speaking about BIOS.
Sure.
And you were explaining how, you know, well, when you hit that power button, that turn on your computer, it takes a while to come to life because the computer's talking to this BIOS system to figure it out what it has to work with.
Right.
And I get that, but what I don't understand is you close all your files and then you push the power button to turn it off. Why does it take so long to finally go off then?
Okay, that has nothing to do with the BIOS. And that is entirely a separate issue. When you run a computer, these days, most hard drives are fast, particularly if you have an SSD hard drive. But operating systems were written in the days when spinning hard drives at 5,400 RPM were the norm. So what they would do is you could either wait, and trust me, these days it would seem like
eternity.
Hours for a hard drive, for a program to write data to a hard drive. So what it did was it would buffer it, give you back your system so you could do something else, and then in the background, write that buffer to the hard drive without bothering you anymore. So when you shut it down, the first thing it does is it closes out all the programs, waits to make sure they're really all closed, makes sure the buffers have all been written to the hard drive, spins down the hard drives, which doesn't do anything on an SSD, but still it waits for that, and then it shuts down. And nowadays, of course, it also makes sure it also disconnects itself from all the internet things it's connected to and makes sure that those are all shut down.
And it's not just the programs you run yourself. It's every other program in the PC that runs the OS underneath. If you look at your process viewer or activity monitor on the Mac, I've got 680 processes running over 3,000 threads.
TSRs.
Right? And when I quit, shut down the computer, all of those have to be quit normally and finish running before the rest of the computer shuts down.
Right. So there's a lot going on in the background that you don't normally see, but in order to make sure that all data are written, all files are closed correctly, all programs are shut down correctly, and all internet connections are terminated correctly, it takes a bit.
So most people just never shut down their computer.
That's why so many people don't shut down their machines.
Okay, thanks. That was interesting.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks.
Then in the olden days, you'd get a message on screen that it was safe to turn off your computer.
Yep.
Because the computer couldn't physically power itself off.
Right.
And we had a bunch of monitors that a company turned in for recycling that were burned in, it's safe to turn off your computer. So, and it takes years, and it was in color. So monochrome monitors burned in pretty quickly, but a color monitor takes a long time to burn in.
And if it's an LED monitors, don't burn in normally. It really takes a very, very,
very, very long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the whole screen animation, screen savers, were originally literally to save the screen.
Right.
Now it's screen animations, so you can make it do fun things.
Yeah, like the old fish tank. Remember
fish tank
that?
Or toasters. Or
the toaster, flying pigs. Toasters.
Bouncing cows.
Bouncing cows?
Bouncing cows. One of the screensavers on Linux is called Bouncing Cows.
I haven't seen that one.
Literally a cow that bounces up and down on the screen like it's on an off-screen trampoline. And you can have up to 8 of them at once.
Jeez.
And that has been my screensaver for 20 years. Easy.
Okay.
Did you read the news that some farmer discovered a cow using a tool?
Yes, I saw that.
It plucked a branch off of a tree and was scratching its back.
And the picture is of it using a broom to scratch its rump.
Oh,
that places it can't reach.
Whoa.
So that's why, you know, cows and horses will usually stand alternating head to butt, so each other's tails can swipe away the bugs.
Yep.
Well, I've seen farmers in there put out like these, they look like big brushes that are out in the
car wash. Yeah.
And they go out there and they'll just rub themselves on that.
Yep.
Again, to just get the bugs off of it.
Yep. But yeah, I used for many years. There's a whole bunch of screensavers on Linux that are pretty cool. Some of them are, okay. But a lot of them are pretty cool. And
hey, James, where are you going?
I actually found a screensaver for text windows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially the pipes. Remember pipes?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's a little bash program. Bash is the one of the shells that you can run like PowerShell under Windows in the terminal, and it's a bash shell that runs a kind of a pipes thing. It's very funny.
Apple has a bunch of really beautiful screensavers built in. 4K resolution, cities around the world. There's a really neat one of California dolphins playing the kelp forest, Aurora Borealis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is James from Rochester, New York. What's up, James?
Oh, good afternoon, Nick and Dave and Steve. I have a question for you. I have the Google Chrome, and is there a way to rename the tabs that I pin on top? Because currently they show like a logo. And I remember in the old days you can like write a few letters and a name on it. Can that be done?
Not that I know of.
Try right-clicking on it. Because usually the name of the tab is what the website named that page.
Right.
Yeah.
But you might be able to right-click on it and change the tab.
You can't. No, I just looked.
No.
So I can't write a little name or like a couple initials to remind me?
Right. No, I'm afraid not.
Oh, they used to have it in the old days.
Yeah, they did.
You can change the bookmark name.
Now, there are extensions that you can add to Chrome that let you do this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's one called Tab Renamer. There's another one called Simple Tab Renamer. And there's another one called Rename Monkey.
Okay. Are they safe?
As far as I know, they are, yes. They're pretty well known, and they're pretty well, a lot of people use them. So when you go, check the reviews and check the rating, and that'll tell you which one you want to use. And, of course, if you don't like one, you can always uninstall it and put in another one. But basically, they let you change the tab names. One of them, I know for a fact, I can't remember which one, lets you change the icon. And check to see that they include persistent naming. So if the page reloads or whatever, that it retains that name.
Yeah, some of the ones like that I have, like for example, Amazon has a big A, so obviously that one's not a problem. Twitter has the X, but some of them have like a logo that doesn't really, you know, bring anything to mind, and I used to be able to put a name in, but I'm going to try this renaming extension and see how it works out.
Yeah, just go into the extensions and search for rename, and you'll see several.
Thank you, Nick and Dave.
All right, have fun, James.
Thank you.
So, yeah, there are extensions. Extensions to do dang near anything.
Yeah. So we still do, but we used to do bookmarks. And, yeah. you can rename your bookmarks. But now
right.
you can pin a tab, and you can't rename the tab. It's whatever name the website wanted it to be.
Right.
And it's interesting to see how people use the new tools when you're used to using the old tools. I can't pin a tab because I have bookmarks. That's right. How I know to get to my stuff.
Right. And one of the things that I do is I put in my bookmarks, I make folders.
Yeah.
And you can open the whole folder. And if there's too many things in the folder, it'll come and say, you really want to open 34 tabs?
Mm-hmm.
For Dave, that's Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
But for the rest of us,
that's a norm for
that
me.
That will give you pause.
So, you know what it's like now on a 4K 34-inch monitor?
You're going to run out of memory before you run out of tab space.
That's the other problem, especially with Chrome and the memory leaks.
That's a thing to remember always for all of you. The more tabs you have open, the more memory you're taking up, and therefore the less memory you'll have for other things. Chrome will background certain tabs if you don't use them for a while, which is nice. And you can also mute a tab by right-clicking on that tab. So if something is playing in a tab and you don't want to listen to it, you can mute that tab.
Well, that's one thing I got to admit, at least upstairs in the ham room. You know, I've got my Chrome, which has, you know, all the tabs that if I want to check the emails and various websites, you know, it's there. I can open it up. But for the most part, I've switched over to, DuckDuckGo.
Sure.
And I only have 4 tabs open there.
What, you piker?
I know it. But I've gotten to where I can just, those are the 4 programs that I'm constantly using. So, like you say, why have other stuff open that I'm not using and slowing things down?
Yep.
And on the other computer, I have the Chrome open, so if I'm expecting an email or something like that, I can check that, but I'm not usually using that.
Right.
Whereas the one main one, I'm 4 tabs now. I was pretty proud of myself.
You're basically Marie Kondo at this point.
Yeah, I slimmed and trimmed.
Now, do you use vertical tabs?
You can now use vertical tabs.
That was big in Firefox for a long time.
Yeah, and now you can do it in Chrome as well.
Hmm.
That's just having the sidebar open with a list of your tabs.
Well, but but what's nice about that is you have more real estate this way, sideways, than you do up and down. So that's why on this machine, my icon bar is on the left.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have more real estate left to right than I do up and down. And the icon bar takes less of my real estate when it's off on the left. You can do that on Windows. You can do that on Mac. You can do that on any operating system nowadays. And that's why Fred was talking about using GNOME on Ubuntu. And GNOME does that. The icons are off on the left. And you can change the size of the icons, make them bigger or smaller, depending on whatever works for you. That way I maximize the amount of space I have available for information and minimize the amount of space I have for navigation.
Whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's just a little tip from us to you.
Yeah.
Make
your life a little easier and have your machine run a little more efficient.
Yep. All right, I'm going to read the Google and Apple news. There wasn't a lot of both that was really worthwhile this week, so I combined them,
yeah.
Cybersecurity researchers have disclosed details of an ongoing campaign that uses a malicious Google Chrome extension masquerading as an ad blocker to deliberately crash the web and trick victims into running arbitrary commands. The malicious extension is currently named NextShield, Advanced Web Guardian. But we'll be seeing it under many different names. If your system crashes and you get messages telling you how to fix it, uninstall the last extension you installed. Don't follow the instructions, particularly if they tell you to call somebody or click here. Cybersecurity researchers have disclosed details of a security flaw that leverages indirect prompt injection targeting Google Gemini as a way to bypass authorization guardrails and use Google Calendar as a data extraction method. The attack gets activated when a user asks Gemini a completely innocuous question about their schedule. A fix is in place, but be careful what you ask any AI and view the results with a great deal of skepticism. OpenAI recently started testing ads in ChatGPT in the United States if you use the $8 Go subscription or a free account, but Google says it does not plan to put ads in Gemini, at least for now. However, Google is not denying that it will never add ads to Gemini. Eventually, Google will decide they need the money. Remember, you're not the customer, you're the product. Google has announced that Gemini can now create free SAT practice tests and coach students to help them get higher scores. Lord help us. Those of us who are familiar with AI's propensity to hallucinate will find this more alarming than amusing. On the fun side of AI, Google Photos now lets you make memes of your own images. The new generative AI-powered feature called MeMeme will allow you to combine a photo template and an image of yourself to generate an image of the meme. So brace yourself. Brace yourself.
Scary.
Yeah. Apple's iOS 26.3 update, currently in its second beta phase, emphasizes improving the overall user experiences through targeted refinements. While it does not introduce major new features, the update focuses on performance optimization, battery efficiency, good, and addressing persistent issues reported by users. This is based on the beta release, so we're not sure how much of it will happen in the final February release. An effort led by security research lab, Covert Labs, is actively uncovering troves of mostly AI-related app store apps that leak and expose user data, including names, emails, and chat history. They've created a public registry of those apps called Firehound, and I will coerce Steve into putting that link in just a minute. Of the 198 apps listed so far, 196 exposed user data. And once you've checked that out, give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free at 800-790-0415. I hope you appreciate the fact that I'm volunteering you.
Yes.
What do they call that? Voluntold. I was voluntold. Voluntold.
Today is also the 42nd birthday of Macintosh.
Happy birthday, Mac.
January 24th. The actual day, January 24th, 1984.
Nice.
Was 1984 anything like 1984?
No, but it waited until 2026.
Yeah.
There's a lot of blogs that were talking about the TV commercial. There was stories going that Apple was scared about airing it because they thought it was too strange. So they sold off their two 30-second Super Bowl ads, which were $400,000 each.
Each. Back then.
That's
cheap.
And then went with a one-minute ad for $800,000. And it was a marketing, advertising triumph. They won lots of awards for it. People didn't quite know what to make of it.
Yeah, they really didn't. But it did the exact thing it was supposed to do, which got people talking about Macintosh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's all it was
generated
designed to do.
Interest.
One of the things that is still talked about in a lot of advertising classes is the House of Guitars.
Yep.
Their ads are so weird and so unusual, and yet everybody talks about
they
it.
Remember
everybody
them, yeah.
knows the House of Guitars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what the 1984 ad did. It didn't tell you thing one about anything to do with anything. But it got you talking about the product, thinking about the product, and going into the stores to look at the product.
Mm-hmm.
And the on one of the anniversaries a few years ago, they got the same actress, but no, she was an Olympic hammer thrower.
Right.
But they re-edited the commercial and put an iPod on her.
So oh,
that,
nice.
So that was probably 2000. Well, it came out in 2001, so that would have been like the 2002 Super Bowl.
That's funny. That's nice. Now, of course, all they have to do is tell AI to add an iPod to the woman and we're done.
Yeah. So how much are Super Bowl ads today?
lot.
30 seconds or 8 million?
Is that all?
Yeah.
Is that all? Yeah.
All right, so let's go back 800,000.
That's for 60 seconds.
1984, yeah.
8 million for 60 seconds?
For 30 seconds. Yeah, 8 million American dollars for in this economy?
Holy fudge.
You're not kidding. That's
NFW.
So $800,000 in 1984 was about $2.5 million in today's dollars.
Yeah.
So that was quite a bit then.
Yep.
Still quite a bit now. I mean,
yeah.
30 seconds, $8 million?
8 million American dollars. Yep.
And I have one hell of a product.
And think of how many Budweiser ads are in the Super Bowl every year. And they're all minute ads.
Mm-hmm.
Super Bowl I was $37,000.
Yeah, for a minute.
For a minute.
Yeah.
No, 30 seconds, sorry.
Oh, for 30 seconds.
Do you remember the old Schultz and Dooley?
Oh, I had Schultz and Dooley mugs.
Yeah.
Still have them, as a matter of fact.
It was always, how were they going to, you know, when they first came out.
There was a whole series of them. There was a cop, and there was a barmaid, and there were all kinds of people in the Schultz and Dooley mugs. I remember those.
A lot of the younger generation that's listening to us wouldn't have a clue.
They don't even know what mugs
heck
are.
We are talking about. Yeah.
Schultz and Dooley were pewter mugs, the kind with lids on them, and the lids were faces.
The old German Steins,
the lidded Steins. And they did a whole series of commercials with Schultz
they
and
were
Dooley
good.
And police officers
yeah.
and the barmaid, and there were a couple of others. And they sold the mugs.
Oh, yeah.
They were you know, merch in those days. That was the merch.
Mm-hmm.
Although, in many cases, they gave them away. My father did refrigeration repair for a company that had most of Monroe County and did all the bars and restaurants. We had more bar merch. If they made a clock, a sign, a mug, something for a beer or a wine or a spirit of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
We had that. So I have Schultz and Dooley mugs.
Cool.
Yeah. Those were, and the real ones, not the reproductions. Mm-hmm. These are the real ones.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they're probably worth a buck and a half these days.
Well, you never know.
But those were the days, man. I grew up with that stuff and that, to me, logoed merch still means you're rich because that's what I grew up with.
Yep.
You know, none of my friends had that. We had that.
There's a woman on one of the podcasts I listen to that she collects logo merch from dissolved companies.
Oh, nice.
And she's excited about her Theranos hoodie.
Oh, very good. What does she have from Enron?
She got something from Enron. She just mentioned that. I don't remember what it was.
There you go.
She does have something from them.
But yeah, that's that to me. That was the thing, you know. So Rob, if you're listening, I need a new mouse pad. One, yeah. But the basic idea here is that I don't know what were we talking about. Oh dear. Oh, we were talking about the stuff from Google and Apple.
Yeah. Speaking of mouse pads, yeah, mine's getting a little grungy too.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of AI apps that have been put into the various app stores these days. Half of them don't work. Half of them don't work well, and the third half, if you will, are just AI slop that is designed to steal stuff from you. Be very careful what you install from any of these systems. We just talked to James about installing some stuff, but those are well known products
from the Google Play Store, which are vetted.
Yeah. Well, the things in the App Store are vetted, and they still get through.
But then they're found in.
But they're found and removed. But the thing is, so the basic idea is with both app stores, if it's new, don't install it. If it's been there a while, you're probably okay.
And if it's been there too long, a bad guy might have bought it, and it turns evil. Right. That happens too.
Thank you. All right, so we're going to take, that music says we're done for the first hour, but there's a whole other hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe coming your way, a whole other hour of Dave Enright, a whole other hour of Steve Ray's chest at the moment, and a whole another hour of me, Nick Francesco, and a whole another hour of you, but only if you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Whatever you do in the next few minutes, don't go too far. Definitely don't go outside. We'll be back with a whole lot more sound bites. See you on the other side.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece, Rochester. A public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
On Facebook at Jazz 901 FM.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, you're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. And, of course, you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299 or toll-free at 800-790-0415. And while you do that, I will read the security news. There is a concerted campaign of malware-laden browser extensions for Chrome, Firefox, and Edge. There have been over 840,000 attacks since December, that is to say, just this month alone. You can read more about it at the link Steve will post shortly. If you have any of these extensions, uninstall them immediately. Websites that authenticate, he'll do that after I finish reading the news, so don't get excited. Websites that authenticate users through links and codes sent in text messages are imperiling the privacy of millions of people, leaving them vulnerable to scams, identity theft, and other crimes. SMS messages, text messages, are sent unencrypted. In the past year, researchers have unearthed public databases of previously sent texts that contain authentication links and private details, including people's names and addresses. One such discovery from 2019 included millions of stored, sent, and received text messages over the years between a single business and its customers. It included usernames and passwords, university finance applications, and marketing messages with discount codes and job alerts. If you get an unsolicited text message that asks you to click on a link, don't. A new family of Android click fraud trojans uses machine learning models to automatically detect and interact with specific advertisement elements. Researchers discovered that the malware can operate in a mode called Phantom, which uses a hidden embedded browser to load a target page for click fraud. The apps are mostly games like Theft Auto Mafia and Cute Pet House, so be careful what you download. 1Password is introducing a new phishing prevention feature that will watch for telltale signs of an attack, such as a web URL that's slightly misspelled. When a 1Password user clicks a link and opens a website with a URL that doesn't match the one they have saved alongside login details, the 1Password browser extension will do two things. It won't autofill their login credentials, and it will display a pop-up warning explaining that the current website's URL isn't linked to a login in 1Password. Snapcraft is being invaded by hackers who are taking over dormant and inactive snaps and using them to steal people's cryptocurrency. Snapcraft is Canonical's platform and ecosystem for Linux applications, closely tied to Ubuntu, but works across many Linux distros. Snaps, on the other hand, are the apps themselves. Like Flatpaks, Snap is a self-contained software package that includes all the application itself, plus most of its dependencies. Many snaps are dormant and their domains have expired. Researchers are saying that the crooks are hunting for expired domains, buying them, and then triggering a password reset on the store. That way they gain legitimate access to the snaps, which they then update to contain malicious code. Canonical has been hard at work trying to curb the campaign, but it's a relentless game of whack-a-mole. As soon as one snap is removed, another one is taken over. The Pwn2Own Automotive Hacking Contest focuses on automotive technologies and took place this week in Tokyo, Japan. Throughout the competition, security researchers targeted fully patched electric vehicle chargers, in-vehicle infotainment systems, and car operating systems. After the first 2 days of the contest, the security researchers earned $955,750 in cash awards after exploiting 66 zero-day vulnerabilities. We're vulnerable, but only emotionally. So be gentle when you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299 or toll-free at 800-790-0415.
A lot of the Pwn2Own competitions, you win the thing you hacked. So the automotive one's got to be pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, if they actually let you keep the thing.
It.
Mostly they're just doing, that's usually
cash
for the computer one, yeah.
Yep. And depending on the difficulty of the exploit and how hard it is to do, you get more points. The master of Pwn points. And at the end, whoever has the most points wins.
Right. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Wayne from Henrietta, New York. What's up, Wayne?
Hello, guys. Wow, my timing could not have been better because it's kind of a follow-up to your news item.
Excellent.
So I was looking to, as I get more and more into Linux, and I'm still having one business app that I have to, Windows business app I have to run, and I messed around with Wine for a while. I kind of got it to work, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
And so I was wondering if you've had any experience working with the Linux version of VMware that you install on Linux. I use the Windows version of it all the time to run Linux on Windows, but I want to go in the other direction. I'm running on Ubuntu. I actually successfully installed it, but there was no snap or Flatpak or anything available to install it, so you had to go to VMware. It's now owned by Broadcom.
Yep.
And they give you a type of package to install, and I actually just installed it this morning. It worked, but I'm always nervous when I'm not installing something from Snap or Flatpak or at least app to a location that I'm familiar with, but it's in a bundle format. So I guess I have two questions. I assume that it's safe because it's coming from, I made sure that I was on the Broadcom website and downloaded it appropriately, first of all.
Right.
But I installed it. But I'm also, I haven't installed, well, I have the application installed. I haven't installed Windows on it yet. I'm just about to do that. But I was wondering if you had any experience with that. It's got to be easier to use than Wine, but, so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on all that.
It's been a while since I used VMware. I mostly use VirtualBox. But it's a very good product, and it does work. Setting it up, you got it. Where did you get your copy?
I got it directly from the Broadcom website. You actually have to set up an account. And they make they now make VMware free for personal use, and that can be they actually they're pretty broad unless you're using it on a corporate site. And so the application that I'm working with, the Windows application, actually recommended either VirtualBox or VMware. And I thought, you know, I've never tried VMware for Linux before. I'm going to give it a try. But it's available for free now. It used to be a pretty expensive application for personal use.
Right. Well, yeah. So VMware Workstation or VMware Fusion are free. And so you can download those and install them yourself. And then you need a VMware package of your program to run.
Or you install Windows with a Windows license.
Right. You install full Windows.
That's true on either platform, for sure.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Right. So both of them, both VMware Workstation and VirtualBox work fine. Like I said, I've mostly used VirtualBox because it's a super easy setup. It's in your distribution. You just install it and you're done.
Okay, so I wouldn't have to go through downloading from the website. It is in a Snap or Flatpak or whatever, depending on your distribution.
It depends on your distribution. It might just be a package that you install through apt or yum or whichever distribution you're running. But yes, you install the VirtualBox directly, and then in that, you create a new virtual machine. For those of you listening, a VirtualBox or VMware lets you create a computer inside your computer. It's called a virtual machine, and it lets you run a different operating system inside your operating system. You have to have a decent amount of RAM and a fast enough processor.
But double the normal because you're running two computers now.
Right, you're essentially running two computers, but you can do that. So if you've got an 8-gig machine, for example, you can create a 4-gig virtual box, virtual machine, and run it. If you've got a 32-gig machine, you could run four gig. Well, that would fill up your machine. So you could run two or three 4-gig virtual machines at the same time. So basically what you do is, let's say you're using VirtualBox. You create a brand new machine and give it X amount of RAM and X amount of disk space. And what I usually say is start at like 20 gig and let it grow as necessary. Cause nowadays everybody's got huge hard drives.
Right.
And then you download the ISO for the program, for the operating system you want to install. So you would download the Windows ISO. And then you just attach that ISO then inside the VMware machine. You not only have the hard drive you created, but you also have a virtual CD-ROM drive, and you mount the ISO as the CD-ROM drive. And now it's just like you're installing it on a real computer from a real CD-ROM drive.
Right.
And then you just say go, and it installs it, and then it's going to ask you for your keys and all the other stuff that Windows normally asks you for, and create your Microsoft account and set it up and yada, yada, yada. But it will work, and depending on how much RAM you've given it and how many processors you've given it and how much disk space you've given it, they run pretty doggone fast.
Indeed, indeed. The only caveat I would add, if anybody follows the trail that I just did and downloading it directly, I did find a video. It doesn't run right away. I found a support video. I can't remember where I found it, but I was careful to make sure that it was a reputable source. But you do have to install some additional packages, and I'm putting it on desktop Ubuntu, and I had to install some additional packages before it worked, but it works like a charm. I haven't tried it yet, but that's as far as I got before I gave you a call. But before I proceeded further, the whole installing of a dot bundle.
So not
going through the normal ways of installing, it always makes me nervous. But Broadcom's got to be pretty reputable, I would hope.
Broadcom is very reputable. VMware is very reputable, and the product definitely works. I wouldn't have a hesitation on that part. No.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, and I'm really appreciating. As we talk more and more about Linux, I'm learning a lot from all of you. So this has been great.
Good. We'd like to hear that. Thanks a lot.
All right. Have a great day, everyone.
You too. Let us know your experience.
I will. Take care.
Thanks. Bye bye.
There's also the commercial program Crossover from CodeWeavers.
Right.
Which is a commercial package of Wine, but it's all set up to install with a one click.
Yes.
And then you get support because you paid for the program.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So some people like that.
And the very little I've done under Linux Mint, for those of you running that, when you go to install a Windows program, it says, okay, look, you have two or three choices here. There's this equivalent in Linux, but it's not the same program. If there's a web app, it will give you the option of using the web app, or we'll install the Windows version with Wine and everything else you need for you. So you don't even have to install Wine yourself and set it all up and get it wrong and delete it and set it up again and get it wrong again. It does it all for you. I was super impressed. I have to say, I was super impressed by that. And it worked very easily and very neatly.
Huh.
But, yeah, so depending on what version of Linux you're running and what it is you're doing, some things are easier than others. The main thing with Linux is that it doesn't run a lot of the same programs you're probably used to. It certainly has a number of Office suites, but it doesn't run Microsoft Office directly unless
you don't need to.
Unless you do it under unless you do it under Wine. And where that has a problem is there are some industries, like some medical industries, medical
the templates,
transcription and stuff, that have special dictionaries and special et cetera, et cetera, lawyers who use special dictionaries and special setups that require Microsoft Office for the software that they run.
Well, yeah, like anything else, there's always going to be exceptions.
Right, right. But aside from that,
yeah,
you know, 99.9% of the people could use the equivalent Linux program like LibreOffice without even noticing the difference.
And that comes with Linux most of the time anyway.
Right.
The vast majority of regular people won't ever need to install anything.
Right.
Comes with a web browser, comes with email, comes with photo editor, comes with all the stuff that basic computer users need. So you don't need to worry about installing anything else most of the time.
Right.
Well, that reminds me, because I just started getting some more notices, because usually it was always in January that I get the notices that QuickBooks, it's time to renew your subscription.
Oh, sure.
So I'm sure you don't want to come back. We got the special offer and all that. And I'm
tax season's coming up. We'll make it easy for you.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, no, thank you. Money Dance is doing a heck of a job, and I'm not paying a yearly fee. Thank you very much.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's there are a lot of things you can do in Linux. A lot of things you can do in Windows, you can also do in Linux.
Yep.
Some of them require learning a new piece of software. And I realize that's annoying. I truly do. But it isn't impossible. You're smarter than you think you are. The question is not how smart are you. The question is how lazy are you. And that's a fact. I'm sorry, but that's a fact. You can learn a new program. It's like when you buy a new car. We've said that how many years? I just bought a new car. Mm-hmm. I'm still reaching for the shift. This new car has buttons instead of shifters. There's a button for drive and a button for neutral. And I'm still, you know, this morning I got in the car and I reached for the shifter. And it's not there anymore. So I'm still, you know, my muscle memory, 16 years of driving the old car, I have 16 years of muscle memory to relearn. But it doesn't mean I can't drive the new car.
Right.
I just have to pay a little more attention. And, you know, I can't automatically switch stations the way I used to when I'm driving, because now I would have to look.
I remember an episode of the British Car Show Top Gear, where they were talking about automotive history and what was the first car to standardize on the pedals the way they are now. Because in the beginning, every car was completely different.
Yep.
Some a lot of the early ones, you had a lever on the left that was your accelerator.
Yep.
And it was the Model T was close to where everything is now. The starter button was a button on the floor. I'm old enough to remember the high beam button on the floor.
Yeah, I remember a starter button on the floor.
Yeah.
My father took his driving test in a Model T Ford.
Yeah.
He did. They're not as old as you think they are.
They're a little tricky to start. So in the episode where they're driving a Model T, they pull up to the front of a hotel to stay the night, and they walk in, and the valet doesn't know what to do with the car.
Can't
get it started. So when they come out in the morning, their car's still there. All right.
I used to have that when I drove a stick shift.
Yep.
They didn't know how to drive. But I will tell you a quick story about Model T Fords and my father. My father went to take his driving test. He couldn't start the car. The guy gets in. He can't start the car. Luckily, they were on a hill. So he just released the parking brake. Went down the hill, popped the clutch,
and off he went.
The guy says, pull over. Oh, crap. My father pulls over. He's sure he's failed the test. The guy started to get out of the car. He said, what are you doing? He said, you passed. Go home. You're done. Go home. You're fine.
Yep.
Yeah.
I saw a YouTube video where a guy took a Model T into a modern Ford dealership.
Oh, nice.
To see what they could do. And so they were driving on not the expressway, but a pretty busy highway, and it could only do 25 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And they were scared.
Yeah.
Everyone. So they pull off, take all the side streets. They get in there, and about the only thing they can do is change the oil.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's still pretty much the same. And then they ask the guy, so what's the oldest computer car you've ever had in here before? Well, we've had some from the 50s. Well, now you've got one from 1910.
Yep.
Yeah, one other thing, though, which would be a lot easier to work on is changing the spark plugs.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, you can't even find them.
Oh,
yeah.
Forget it. Drop the engine and everything else.
That's exactly right.
The brakes were a wooden stick that pressed against the
wheel. Drums.
Yeah,
and then,
the drum.
And if you were lucky, you had the cloth wrap around the stick so it didn't burn off completely.
Yep. Well, it used to be that the big difference between you and a garage was they had tools you didn't have.
Yep. Yeah.
So, for example, I could do a lot in my car back in the day.
Same
I
here.
Couldn't pull the fan, for example.
Yeah, because you need the
you need pulley. The fan puller.
Yep, the pulley.
Right, and I just didn't have one.
Yep.
So you know there were things you couldn't do.
Water
now,
pumps.
Now I don't. I open it up. I can. We could barely find the brake fluid.
Brake
thing.
Fluid thing. Yeah.
I can remember changing the thermostats quite often. You had to get the thermostat because it started overheating. You'd need a new thermostat. You'd get the thermostat and the gasket. And then all you needed was the glue to re-put it on there.
For years, the way I started, for months, back in college, the way I started my car was I'd open the hood, short out the starter. Car would start and I'd get it and drive away.
Jerry?
Well, here's one, 1932 for only 12 grand.
A 1932 what?
Model T.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. There are a lot of them on that. What did I find? Some classic Auto Trader site.
Sure. How much?
11.8, they're asking for it.
That's not bad. Does it run?
Yeah. The one next to it is 12.3.
Oh, that one runs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Hold on, sir.
Rebuilt. Oh, here's a converted Roadster. Took a Model T and converted it into a hot rod.
See, there was a lot of that. That's why there aren't that many Model Ts anymore.
Yep.
They were all chopped.
Just so you can read that. That gentleman is calling from Iceland.
Iceland!
All right.
Wait, the one Trump wants or the other one? All right.
The real Iceland.
All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Jerry, pretending to... Listen, Rochester's Iceland today. What's up, Jerry?
Hi, guys. I have a question about upgrading an older computer.
Sure.
It has a Dell Inspiron D130. It has a 1.7 gigahertz Pentium M, and it's fully loaded with 2 gig of RAM. It doesn't have an IDE hard drive in it, so I installed Linux on a 3.1 USB plugged into the USB 2.0 port.
Sure.
And it runs reasonably well.
Yep.
Okay. So if I go the extra step and actually find an IDE solid state drive that I can put in there, is it going to perk up the performance a lot more or just a little bit? Or, you know, what's the bandwidth difference between a real USB 2.0 flash drive and a PATA solid state drive in such a system?
Okay, so a couple of things. The first thing is on the USB drive, first, 2.0 is slow to begin with. And secondly, everything is compressed on the drive.
Mm-hmm.
So when you pull something off of that thumb drive, it not only is going through a slow connection, but then it has to be decompressed before it can run. That slows things down considerably. So loading and, sorry?
I'm listening. Go ahead.
Yeah. So loading and saving is going to be much, 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 much faster.
Like night and day.
Yeah. The actual performance of the system itself won't change. So once something is loaded, and for example, you're writing a letter or you're playing a game or you're browsing the web, that's going to happen at about the same speed. but the loading and saving is going to be much faster. You're going to find a vast improvement in response time, which is what most people mean with a faster by a faster computer.
Okay. So you, I thought it was doing okay because, I mean, the Pentium M is a really early CPU, one CPU and one thread, doesn't do any of the multi-threading stuff. And I just thought it would be an interesting curiosity to see if I could bring it back to life and ask the question about whether going to a solid-state drive, even on the old IDE-type interface, would help it a lot.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. That will the response time will be much faster.
Better,
The run the actual running won't be. But I'll tell you what, I have run a very similar system to yours with Linux, and yes, running it from the hard drive is much faster, and it is responsive and usable.
I'm actually surprised it can boot from USB. It's got a new enough BIOS for that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I would say if you can find one, you know, it doesn't have to be a big one. I would say go for it.
Yeah, it's going to take a little bit of hunting because it's an old interface.
Yep. Right.
To get to your earlier point, the reason I'm in Iceland is that I needed to get to a place that was going to be a little bit warmer than Rochester, New York.
What is your temperature? Wait a minute. What is your temperature right now?
5 Celsius?
40 in Reykjavik, it says.
Yeah, 5 Celsius.
That's a heck of a lot warmer than it is here.
Way warmer than here. I hate you, Jerry. Also, just in case, get your couch ready. We may be moving with you. So,
how long can you tread water?
Long enough. All right, thanks, Jerry.
All right, guys. Thank you very much. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye. Jerry may be our longest distance call so far. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the international edition of Soundbites right here. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Or all of you in Reykjavik, 1-800-790-0415.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 34 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And listen, Jerry, for those of you who insist that your measurements actually make sense, 11 degrees Fahrenheit is, I believe, 3 furlongs in a gill. I'm not entirely sure, but I think that's it.
I saw an interesting video from an American living in Britain, and then there's another channel with a Briton living in America. And so he was talking about units, and temperature makes sense to use Fahrenheit because it's going to be in the 60s today, or it's going to be in the 80s today. That makes sense. In Celsius, it's going to be 17 today. It's going to be 20 today. That doesn't sound like a big difference.
Somebody once said, Fahrenheit is how humans feel.
Mm-hmm.
Celsius is how water feels. Kelvin is how stars feel.
Yeah. So 100 degrees Fahrenheit is really, really hot. 100 degrees Celsius is dead.
Yes.
100 degrees Kelvin is dead.
The other way. I have a friend in Manila that I talk to regularly, and every time she's always asking me, what's the temperature there? And I always give it to her in Fahrenheit, and she always gives me this face.
Yep.
All right. A collaboration between Drexel University and Seoul National University has delivered a major advance building a stretchable OLED that doubles in size while preserving a steady glow and record efficiency. Potential applications range from industrial displays and soft robotics, to wearable health monitors woven into fabric or applied directly to the skin. There's particular promise in medical and diagnostic devices that could show vital signs in real time, outperforming today's smartwatches and fitness trackers. So someday, your doctor will just look at your shirt and tell you what's wrong with you. I can look at your face and tell you what's wrong with you. TLC is taking majority ownership of Sony's Bravia series of TVs, pending, and I quote, relevant regulatory approvals and other conditions, end quote. The joint venture is expected to launch in April of 2027. The joint venture will continue to release TVs and home audio gadgets under the Sony Bravia branding. However, the TVs will rely on TCL display technology and, oh, by the way, their manufacturing powerhouse that can make things a lot cheaper than Sony can.
Yeah, TCL's always been cheap and Sony's been really good, but too expensive.
Exactly. The joint announcement suggested focus on bigger TVs, higher resolution displays, and smart features. Great, more AI. Wikipedia spent years, speaking of AI, Wikipedia spent years cataloging all the ways you can tell if something was written by AI, so naturally, someone's now created a plugin for Anthropic's Claude Code AI that teaches it how not to do that, how not to sound like AI. Great. Luckily, it's not perfect yet. Speaking of AI, Curl is an indispensable tool among admins, researchers, security professionals, and others for a wide range of tasks, including file transfers, troubleshooting, buggy web software, and automated tasks. Curl is integrated into default versions of Windows, Mac OS, and most distributions of Linux. Recently, the developers instituted a bug bounty program. Well, they were inundated with so much AI-generated slop, they've canceled the program. Speaking of AI... Microsoft is rolling out new artificial intelligence features with the latest updates to the Notepad and Paint apps for Windows 11 Insiders because Notepad needs AI. For Notepad, it now streams AI-generated results for write, rewrite, and summarize features, but you have to sign in with your Microsoft account. We already talked about memifying yourself with Paint, but you can also generate coloring pages from custom text prompts. However, the coloring book option is available only on Copilot PCs and also requires Microsoft account authentication. Microsoft owns you, citizen, and don't you forget it. These features are currently only available to Windows Insiders, so you peons don't get any. Speaking of AI, Asus has confirmed the wind down of its smartphone business. Instead, Asus will focus on AI products like robots and smart glasses. So those of you looking for new ROG phones or Zen phones are out of luck. Both of you. Verizon has started enforcing a 365-day lock period on phones purchased through its track phone division 1 week after the Federal Communications Commission waived a requirement that Verizon unlock handsets 60 days after they are activated on its network. Also, each customer will have to specifically request an unlock instead of getting it automatically. And in non-computer, non-AI news, Netflix agreed to pay all cash for Warner Brothers Discovery, amending its $72 billion with a B-dollar deal in an attempt to fight off Paramount's hostile takeover bid. We'll see who wins after the vote in April. But you don't have to wait to call us, so give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299, or toll-free at 800-790-0415.
Did you read that one of the AI company executives said we're all going to go bankrupt if regular people don't start using AI?
Yeah, well, that was Satya Nadella, wasn't it?
Was it Microsoft? Yeah, I couldn't remember which one. And the first comment on the story was, doesn't he know that regular people are scared of AI and won't use it? Right now it's only tech enthusiasts.
Right. Well, look, it is becoming more and more evident that we are in an AI bubble. And that bubble will burst. Mm-hmm. There are some very good things about AI. Don't get me wrong. There are many times when it is extremely useful. It isn't as useful as they would like us to think it is. And it requires as much work as not using AI to do things like coding and stuff. It can shortcut a lot of things. So, for example, you can always say, how do I do this? And it will generally tell you that. But now you need to test it. Because often it lies.
You got to take it for what it is, and it's very skeptic.
Yeah, it moves.
Very skeptic, because it'll make recommendations, and that's what they are. Recommendations. Don't take them as fact.
Yeah. Right. It moves the workload from coding to testing, because coding, they already don't do enough testing.
Right.
So it's going to get worse.
Well, and students are using it to write papers and then not checking the papers.
Yeah.
My favorite is when they just copy and paste and they leave in the prompt.
Or
how stupid are you?
Or as a generative AI, I'm not allowed to comment on things like that, but if I could,
right.
In the paper.
Right. So, look, AI is like I said, extremely useful
handy
in
tool.
The right circumstance.
It's a tool.
It's a tool, and not everything is a nail. Right? There's, so AI is useful for many things, not everything.
Right.
There's a great Mitchell and Webb sketch to a British comedy pair on the invention of bronze.
Ooh.
And how upset this one guy was that he wouldn't be a flint arrowhead chipper anymore, like his father was, and his grandfather was, and his great-grandfather was, because we're going to go to bronze arrowheads, and bronze is the best.
Bronze is the best. Well, there are people who went out of business because they could no longer sell buggy whips.
Yep.
You know, and I get that. I do.
But if you have automobile accessories...
Right.
Yep.
What scares me is, right now, today, there are people in medical school passing their exams mm-hmm. with AI.
Mm.
That scares me.
Then you're going to ask the AI how to diagnose this disease.
Right.
That was on, what was it?
911.
Well, yeah, but the one I saw on The Pit with Noah Wiley, the kid had measles, and none of the young doctors had ever seen it before.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, God, now you know how old I am.
911 had that where they had an AI...
call center.
Call center for 911.
Told someone to put a tourniquet on their neck to stop the bleeding.
And tighten it.
And tighten it down.
Yeah.
Which is normally what you want to do with bleeding, but not on your neck.
Not on your neck. the thing, like I said, with AI, simple things can be answered simply and easily and are generally correct. The more complex you get, the more esoteric you get, the more you really, really, really have to check the answer. And that's just the fact.
What is the flight speed of an unladen swallow?
Right. African or... Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reality
miles an
is
hour.
People
no.
who actually know something will always be faster than people who have to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
And they will generally be more correct because they actually know a thing rather than parroting what they've read somewhere else, which also they don't retain.
Yeah. I read an interesting essay by Isaac Asimov ages ago who was calling for to stop teaching how to do logarithms in school. Because you can just look it up on your slide rule.
Right. Right.
And we've run into similar things now with calculators. You still have to know how to do the math,
mm-hmm.
but the calculator can get the arithmetic right.
Right, right. And that's exactly right.
And so that, what was it, the Beagle Mars probe crashed because somebody transposed a digit.
Right. You really need to understand the underlying concept and then let the computer do the scut work
yep.
of actually computing. That's mm-hmm. what they're for. But you have to understand what it is you need to compute and how to do it.
Like they say, garbage in, garbage out.
So, all right, here's an example. Somebody was asking me this week, if you type uptime into a Linux terminal, you get the amount of time the system's been on,
mm-hmm.
and you get three numbers, which are how busy the system has been 1 minute, 5 minutes, 15 minutes, the last minute, the last 5 minutes, the last 15 minutes. That number is a percentage. A percentage of what? It's a decimal number.
Mine is 9.35.
And
I'm doing multi-video streaming here.
Right. Well, but what does 9.35 mean?
Yeah.
So what it is it's... The formula is you take that number, divide it by the number of processors in your system, or cores, the number of cores in your system, and then multiply that by 100. Now you've got an actual percentage of how busy your system is.
Okay.
So that'll tell you your system is 47% busy, which is the number we understand.
Yeah.
The idea is that code that gives you that 0.04, or when you get 9.35, that was written back in the days when there was one processor. And what that means is you're as busy as nine processors. Well, now you've got 32 cores. So 9.35 is not even a busy machine. So what did you get? I know you're doing it.
72.
72%.
I've got 8 CPU cores and 10 GPU cores.
Right. So you're at about, would you say 72%?
Yeah.
Yeah. So his machine is 72% busy. 9.35 doesn't tell him anything.
No.
72% is a number that humans understand.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they've never changed that.
We can relate to that.
Yeah. My little bar chart is about hovering about 50%.
Right.
And lower. It's not jumping very high. It's for 72%.
Well, it may not be using all the GPU cores.
Yeah, it could be the task that it's doing.
Well, that's true. Using. CPU, GPU, or both.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, you may find that it's doing more or less or something else in there. But the idea is that you don't, in fact, I would say, I don't know. I would say that if you're looking at, because 9 divided by 8, no, that's even worse. So you need to know the underlying theory of what you're looking at before what you're doing makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And AI often doesn't know that.
I mean, I like AI, you know, in the browsers for searching for stuff. You know, if I've got a particular question, how would I do this? And
yes.
Sit there and have it go out. Or, all right, I'm looking for a certain file. Where would they have buried it?
You know,
and it'll come back and say, you know, if you say the program and what you're looking for, it does a great job.
But even so, sometimes it's wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you still, right, yes. But again, those are simple things. Those are things you can look up. One of the things that I did, and this, Steve Organic gets all the credit for this. I was talking about my new car and how I, you know, got to read a 600-page manual. He said, why don't you import it into Notebook LM? And then just ask Notebook LM.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Because now, Notebook LM, you can say, only use this source.
Yep.
Right? So here are the sources that I know are accurate. In this case, it's one manual, but it's a 600-page manual.
But still, I know this source is
accurate. Right. I know this source is accurate. Use only this source. Don't go out on the web and find nonsense.
Yeah.
Use this source. So now I can say, well, what is this? How do I do this? Where is that? Where is that? And it will find the exact answer in the manual and give it to me.
And that you know you can trust.
That I know I can trust because it's coming right out of the manual. And I know that because I have verified it about half the time. I go back and look. But in under those kinds of circumstances, you can pretty well trust AI. But when you're going out on the web and it's taking data from everywhere, much of which is wrong, you have to be wary. And not enough people are. And like I said, we're looking, and that's part of the problem. AI was the new hotness,
mm-hmm.
but now people are realizing that AI A has limitations, and B is often just completely wrong, and they're becoming disillusioned. AI isn't the end all be all cure all
because it isn't artificial intelligence.
It really isn't.
No, it's just relying on data that it collected over time,
right.
And you know if you've got a program that just came out. And it's grabbing data that's from the older version of that program, they're not going to relate as far as what you're trying to accomplish in it. If you're looking up something, you know, because with the newer software, say, it might have changed things around and now it handles it this way and that way. And, you know, if it's relying on AI to go back and, you know, old manuals and everything else, it's going on the older stuff, which might not even be correct.
That's exactly right. Or it followed somebody who just lied about it.
Yeah.
Or was misinformed and spewed about that, and it picked that up. So yeah, I if I'm going to make a choice between trusting an expert in the actual thing or AI, I'm going to trust the expert.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way that goes. But AI is free and convenient, and experts often cost money, and you have to go find them.
And you can also take it, like we said before, take it for what it's worth and look it over. See if it makes sense. And if it's taking you in another direction, you're sitting there saying, what the heck? You know, back off. Take it, like you say, take it for what it's worth and question it. question it severely.
I did that the other day. I was going to a customer, and I typed in their address, and I took the first autocomplete, which was wrong.
Yeah.
Oops.
But it wasn't entirely wrong, but that last turn, wait, why did I turn left? I should have turned right.
back in the day, this is, I was probably 10 years old, so 1540. Well, back when doctors were still making house calls. We got a doorbell rang one day. We opened the door, and there was a doctor standing there, and he said, I'm here to see the patient. He said, there's nobody sick here. He said, well, I've been told to come to 180 Lincoln Street. Okay, this is Lincoln Avenue in the city. Mm-hmm. You want Lincoln Street in Pittsburgh? You're in the wrong place.
Wrong town.
You're in the wrong
town. The other side of town.
Right, it's going to take you 20 minutes to get there, 30 minutes in those days. But yeah, that was an honest mistake. Now you can make it at the speed of computers.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And that can be tough. We've got a couple customers that live on Route 15, but the name changes. Like every town is a different name.
Yeah.
And so it says to go to Main Street. What town?
Yeah. Right. So yeah.
Well, you get there and have the zip code.
Yeah.
Zip code will help.
Yeah. What I like is recently, at least, I've noticed that when I say to Google Maps, navigate to somebody's house, it will say navigating to 123 any street. So I can hear it say, this is the address I'm going to. So if it gets it wrong, I can say stop. And let's go back and change that. So I do like that part. But yeah. Yeah. But one other doctor story. Back in the mid-70s, I was feeling really, really, my stomach was killing me. I was really sick. So I was doing summer stock in this little town in the middle of nowhere. And they sent me to a doctor who was about 109 years old and a woman. And I felt very comfortable because back when this woman got her degree, she had to be six times as good as any male doctor to get the job. So she said, she listened to all my symptoms, very sympathetic. She said, here, go pee in this cup. And she just held it up to the light and said, oh, you're lactose intolerant. I said, wait a minute. She said, your symptoms could have been one of two things. If it was the other thing, your urine would be cloudy. Your urine is not cloudy. You're lactose intolerant.
Whoa.
Okay. And she was right. I am. Mm-hmm. And she just, you know, she didn't look anything up. She didn't think about it for an hour. She didn't have a computer in those days at all, but she certainly didn't type anything in and wait. She just knew. It was all in her head, and it was all right there. And she just said, this is it. You have this.
Yep.
Stop drinking a quart of milk at lunch every day. Okay.
Yeah,
I did, and I was fine after that. So, yeah, it worked out. It worked out. But those are the people that you cherish.
It goes back to medical students using AI. What do you call a person who graduates last in their class? Doctor.
That's true. That's absolutely true. So, yeah, there's just, look, again, AI can be very helpful. One of the problems that I think Microsoft is having is they have admitted that at least 30% of their code is written by AI. And look at all the problems.
But then he recanted and said he didn't really mean that.
Yeah, he said he didn't mean that, but he already said it. And look at the problems that they're having that they can't fix because there's nobody left at Microsoft who knows what the code did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not very well documented either.
Well, it's not documented, and all they do is say, what's wrong with this code, and paste it in. Well, you're just asking the thing that wrote bad code to fix the bad code. It isn't going to happen.
Yeah. They had posted a example workflow of how vibe coding, letting the AI do it, and said, well, this routine is giving a overflow error. How do, you know, why, and how do we stop it? And the AI said, well, put a bounce check in.
Well, okay.
So then it won't go over value anymore, right?
Okay. That doesn't fix the problem.
It fixes the symptom.
Error. It does fix the problem.
Yeah.
You don't get the error anymore, but you also don't get the code running.
Yeah. Why is this not working?
Right. At some point, the value of somebody who actually knows something is much greater than the value of a computer that thinks it knows something.
Was it a new programmer says, hey, it worked on the first try? Yeah. A longtime programmer says, it worked on the first try?
Now I'm worried. Something isn't right.
Yeah.
Well, I had a long discussion this week with somebody on Counter Social about automated home devices and how I don't use any. Thank you very much. Because who's selling my data? We already know Ring will give all of your data to every police officer who asks for it without a warrant, by the way. I want control of my data. Mm-hmm. There are other camera doorbells you can use that don't do that, that keep all your data internal to your own servers. But, of course, they cost, and you have to set it up and do all of that stuff. But it's a very different thing. So you need to do more research rather than just run out and buy the first smart light bulb or smart security camera you see, because you don't know what's happening with your data in the background. All right, that music tells us we are done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in from all over the world. I want to thank Dave Enright. I want to thank Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. I want to thank all of you listening. It's you folks who make this happen every week. Without you, we'd be sitting around warm indoors. I shouldn't go there. All right, we're done for another week. But we will be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites, right here on the truly great and truly grateful to you that we continue to be member-supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another and stay warm, will you?